All right, I think we're ready. Yeah. Okay, so today we are really looking at part two of the story that we started over a month ago now. And just to recap for some of you who weren't here, our story took us last time to Libya. And really this story is Brother Andrew's story of his later life when he started really working amongst the Islamic nations and really, I guess, trying to encourage the church there that was being so isolated and marginalized by the majority Muslim, often government, or at least the influence of the majority Muslim population. And his work was really to try and encourage and build up those churches there. We talked last time about, our story centered on this man by the name of Boutros, who chose to go back to Libya as a Christian from the UK. And it was a very difficult decision for him because he knew, of course, that going back to Libya would mean that he would be persecuted, it would be very difficult, life would be very difficult for him. But he chose to do that because he really felt called to witness and support and build up those churches there, you know, working with priests and clergy and pastors on all different denominations. And there weren't very many of them, and many of them had no resources and felt very unsupported. Their congregations were often dwindling, and he really felt a need to go and strengthen what remains. But his work changed a lot when he started to realize that there were people, Muslims, who were coming to know the Lord. And there were three young men in those early years. We had Ahmed, Mustafa, and Hassan. All three of them came to the Lord, even though they were from very radical or very devout Islamic backgrounds. And they came to the Lord so miraculously, and their lives were so completely changed. But Boutros realized that he had another job to do, and that was to disciple these Muslim background believers who were caught in limbo between the Christians and the Muslims. Neither wanted them. Even the Christians were very suspicious of Muslim background believers. There was tension there because they'd been betrayed so many times by people posing to have been converted when actually they were spies. So these three men, had so much faith, and Boutros really felt a need to strengthen them, teach them, and help them walk before the Lord. These three men made the very difficult decision to be baptized. Their baptism wasn't in a church building or anything like that. It was in some warehouse, some abandoned warehouse. They all arrived at different times, remember, because it was so dangerous. Being baptized in a Muslim nation was a very clear and decisive symbol that you were going to follow the Lord and you had rejected entirely Islam. And so baptism really was signing a bit of a death sentence, or at least an arrest warrant for yourself, because people were arrested for being a Muslim who got baptized, or their family could kill them and there would be no investigation, because being baptized was a real clear sign to the Muslim community that you had rejected your Islamic faith. Boutros had taken so many precautions, and yet, after these men returned from their baptism, all three of them, Ahmed, Hassan and Mustafa, were arrested. And that's where our story ended last week, and we'll continue from there. Now, for Ahmed, this day of his baptism was the most significant. When he came up out of that water, he felt like he had joined a family of people. He had a new life, and he shared this life with millions of people, not just in Libya, but across the whole globe. And not only that, but people from 2,000 years of history. And he felt that he was now part of something very new. And he understood the fact that he had died to his old life, and he was, I guess, born again into a very, very new life. And this was really consolidated because Ahmed had asked Brother Andrew, who was there, to give him a new name, an English name, but also a Christian name, because his name, Ahmed, was very much a Muslim name. And so Brother Andrew had chosen the name Timothy. And Ahmed had read about Timothy and knew that he was the apprentice to the Apostle Paul. And that as the apprentice, he, as a young man, was tasked with the great task of speaking and strengthening and preaching and strengthening the church across Asia Minor. And so Ahmed really felt that he wanted to follow in those footsteps, and he felt called. He had a new name, it was a new start, he had a new life. When he returned home, he actually went straight out for a walk. And as he walked through the streets, he was thinking about it, and then he finally turned back and came back to his flat. But when he came back to his flat, he noticed that there were police cars all through his street. And when he saw that, suddenly the reality of his situation hit him, and he just ran. He took off, and he ran through the city streets, and he didn't know where he was going, he didn't know what to do. But at one point he just stopped, and he thought, I can't keep running. What if they'd probably got Mustafa? I wonder what they've done with Hassan. They're probably after Boutros. If they can't find me, they'll go elsewhere. And so he decided that he would go back. And when he got to his flat, his landlord was waiting for him and said, the police have been here, and I need to let you know. They've told me if I see you, that I need to call them. And so Ahmed said to him, well, go ahead, call them. And the landlord looked at him and sort of thought, are you sure? But he said, I'll wait here, just call them. And so his landlord called the police, and the police, of course, came and took him in. At first he thought it was just for questioning, but then he realized that they were trying to pin some sort of charge on him. At first they were saying, you were involved in illegal religious meetings. You've converted Muslims. You yourself have converted. You know, we're going to hold you for this. And Ahmed at first was a bit upset about this because there was no real formal charge. They had arrested him and they were holding him, they were questioning him, but he kept asking, what's the charge? And they couldn't really tell him. But then he refused to give them information. And they started asking for other names. They wanted names, they wanted places. And Ahmed just refused. He didn't want to hear, he didn't want to give them anything. And of course that then started the beating. He was taken, he was kicked, he was punched. And they kept saying, give us the names. We need names. We know you know other people who've converted from Islam to Christianity. You must know some other names. Give me those names. But he refused. And at that moment when, I guess, he was behind bars and he started to see this whole injustice of this situation, he started to feel a bit angry. There was no charge against him. They were holding him. They were manhandling him, kicking him, punching him. But Boutros had told him many, many months ago, not just him, but Mustafa and Hassan as well, to memorize the book of Philippians. And in this moment, a verse came to mind from chapter 2, not just one verse, a few verses. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. And being found in appearance as man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. And so Ahmed realized that here was his opportunity to trust God in this situation and have the mind of Christ, even in the injustice of it all. Well, because he refused to give information, they held him in a cell. Day blurred into weeks as he was taken out every day, and then they started the torture. Now, Ahmed had known that the Libyan prisons were, that nobody really knew what went on in there, which of course meant bad things happened in those prisons. But he had no idea of the cruelty that went on. He was taken, he was given electric shocks, and still he refused. So he was hung by his clothes and by ropes to the ceiling rafters, and the guards used him as a punching bag until he lost consciousness. They broke his ribs, they beat the soles of his feet until he couldn't stand up. But he still refused, and in his mind was constantly, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. No charge had been laid against him at all, but he was being treated like the enemy of the state. Yet, week turned into week, turned into month, and there he was in a cell. And so one day he was transferred to another prison. And at this point he was so sleep deprived, and so his face was swollen, one eye was swollen shut, his ribs had been fractured, and he couldn't really move. He didn't actually know what was happening around him. He was often in and out of consciousness. But he realized that the place he was in now, there were other people. He wasn't just alone. And one day when he was well enough, he could actually go outside, and all the prisoners were taken outside and they were told to go into the yards. When he was out there in the yards, he heard his name and he looked, and Mustafa and Hassan were there as well. And they saw each other and they came together and they whispered together, and they all realized that they'd been interrogated. They tried to get names from them, and Hassan said, I told them nothing. And Ahmed encouraged them and said, this is our opportunity. Remember what we learnt with Philippians. Let this mind be in you that was also in Christ Jesus. And they finished the verse for him. They had also memorized it. They were all split up again, and they went back into their various cells. And Ahmed, at this point, you know, prayer was pouring out of him. He had realized that the greatest imprisonment he had ever experienced was his own sin. And Jesus had liberated him from that. And all of this was nothing in comparison. And he had this great clarity during this time. He knew that it was only Jesus. Jesus was the way, the truth, and the life, and had overcome the world. And he hung on to that. Now, back in the cell, when he was lying there, he heard a voice from the back corner, and someone said, hey, we heard you're a Christian. You know, we get a reward if we can convert you back to Islam. And so Ahmed called back and said, well, brother, give it your best shot. He was so sure that Jesus was the way. Nobody was going to convert him back. Meanwhile, Boutros was desperately searching for information. He knew the system. Brother Andrew was with him at this point, and they were going from police station to police station trying to get news. Where were they held? What was happening? And they were being frustrated at every turn. They knew people were lying to them. They knew that somebody must have known where they were. They knew that the local police would have known. But no one would give them any information at all. And so Boutros was very angry about this situation. And Brother Andrew and he went to a lawyer. And they said, you know, what are our options here? What can we do? They've been just taken. We don't know where they are. We need to get the options. And the lawyer told them, you know what Libya is like. The police can hold someone for 2 months without a charge. They just arrest you, and for no reason. And they can hold you. They're allowed to hold you for up to 2 months. And the lawyer said, you can't do anything about that. And then, of course, after the 2 months is up, they can just extend it for another 2 months and then do that again. And Brother Andrew said, but surely you can't hold someone without any charges. And this lawyer said, actually, you can. And that's our system. And Brother Andrew just couldn't believe the injustice of it. And of course, Boutros said, you know, they could be killed in there. I know what these Libyan prisons are like. And the lawyer said, nothing you can do. And even if they are, there will be no investigation. It'll just be, it happened by accident. That's what always happens. And so Brother Andrew was really frustrated by this. It was time for him to go back to Holland. But when he was going back to Holland, he thought that there must be some way, something we can do for these three young men. So within 24 hours of arriving, Brother Andrew had written an article. And he decided that if the justice system in Libya was so terrible, it was actually an injustice system, then he would use another method. A method that generally got response. And that was a bit of pressure from the West. So he wrote an article about these three men and what was happening, and he sent it to all the various people he knew, radio stations, TV, news, different channels here and there across Europe, and people he knew in America. He also got his some staff at Open Doors to write about it in their various magazines. And so they sent this out, they asked people to pray, and Brother Andrew really felt strongly about this. You see, he really felt that people who were being persecuted for their faith, they needed to know that they were being supported by other Christians across the other side of the world. And he really felt that, you know, we need to be praying. We have freedom. We need to be praying for our brethren who are being persecuted overseas. And that's what he wrote about. And he got thousands of people to pray for Mustafa, Hassan and Ahmed. Around the same time, Abuna Alexander, the faithful old priest in the town, actually it was Ahmed's hometown, he was really struggling. Around the same time, in this particular area, the Muslim Brotherhood, which was a radical Islamic group, was gaining influence. And Fridays were now becoming the worst day of the week, because this was the day that a lot of the Muslims attended the mosque. And this was the day where the imams often preached hatred, the idea of purging Libya from the dirty religion of Christianity. And people would come out of those mosques angry and fired up, and things would happen. There'd be, you know, a car set on fire or something would be smashed, and the young men would run through the streets. And so Friday was always a very tense day. But on this particular Friday, it was... Abuna Alexander felt that it was even worse. He heard a roar coming from the mosque, and he knew that the young men again were on a rampage. But this time it was very, very serious. They ran through the main streets, and whatever had been happening, whatever literature they'd been given and talks they'd been given, they went and aimed for all the Christian businesses. Anything that was known to be owned by a Christian was smashed. Any place that sold pork or alcohol was completely destroyed. Cars were burnt, everything. And the Christians had to run for their lives. Soon, you know, Abuna Alexander was standing next to his phone, and it was going off, and he heard, you know, the local butcher rang him and said, his name was Bashir, he said, "They're coming, you know, it's dangerous here. Whatever you do, don't come here. They're coming, they've smashed everything." And then the phone went dead. Another person rang and told him of what had happened over here and over there. And he stood by the phone, just frozen to the spot, knowing that, well, if he went out there, of course, that wouldn't bring any peace. And he just didn't know what to do. And his wife stood by him, and all she could say was, "Lord Jesus, Son of God, have mercy on us." Now, Bashir came later that night, and he was crying. And he said to Abuna Alexander, "I can't do this anymore. I have to get out of Libya. I have family. I have a relative in Europe. I'm going to try everything I can to get out. I can't. My young family, I've been financially ruined. They've totally burnt my shop. I have nothing left." And Abuna Alexander looked at him, and then he realized that many months ago he had been worried about the fact that he had a leak in his roof in the church building, and that it was crumbling, and that there was graffiti and vandalism. But now all of that mattered not at all, because he could see that his flock, his small congregation, were terrified and were starting to scatter. So he said, "Bashir, don't think about that just yet. Tonight we need to visit those who are suffering." Boutros had been called again to meet with a man by the name of Karim. Now, we know Karim was a high government official. He seemed like a devout Muslim, but actually he was a converted Christian. He had been converted by his own study of the Bible, and he'd come to realize that Jesus was the way. We don't know exactly who he is. It's very, very sketchy. He could be a member of the royal family in Libya. He could be a diplomat or a high government official. But we know that he had a lot of influence. And he came to Boutros, and he wanted to meet him again. And this time they met in a really fine dining restaurant in the capital. They had a private room. It wasn't just a normal restaurant. They had a private room and a private waiter. And they would ring a bell and the waiter would come into the room. In that way, Karim ensured that there was complete privacy. Of course, no one could know that he was a Christian. In this particular fine dining restaurant, you know, the chef was one of the 200 best, one of the Michelin-starred chefs, a French chef and so on. And so Boutros, of course, had the nicest meal of his entire life. But in this time, they could speak frankly to each other, and they had complete privacy. And so Karim told Boutros that he actually knew everything that was going on. He knew that Ahmed and Mustafa and Hassan had been taken. He also knew that they'd been held at a certain prison. He had also found out that there had been international pressure. There had been articles, and the government in Libya was aware of it. Articles had been written, people had been writing letters. And so, of course, the government was a bit nervous about this. You see, the government had signed the UN Charter of Human Rights and did not want the international spotlight to come on them. They knew their prison system was very corrupt and very, of course, it violated human rights significantly. And they were very nervous that the big spotlight of the West would suddenly turn on them. And so they were looking at ways of trying to release these three men. But of course, there were other people that didn't want them released. So, and Karim also knew who had betrayed them. It was somebody from a church that they had visited once. Somebody who'd seen them, or somebody who'd been there. And so they knew, and so Boutros realized how much Karim knew about what was going on. They talked, and at the end of their discussion, Karim said, you know, I've read in the Bible about the prophet Daniel, and I sort of see that perhaps I am like that man, Daniel. You know, he had to serve the king in Babylon, but his heart was elsewhere. And Boutros took a huge risk here, and he challenged Karim and said, if you're like Daniel, then there may be a time when the Lord calls you to submit to a higher authority, and you may not be able to stay in secret or in hiding for much longer. But perhaps for now your position is going to be, you have this position for a reason. And Karim, instead of feeling a bit offended or angry about this, particularly because he was a very high up government official, his face crumpled a little bit, and he said to Boutros, you need to pray for me. You need to pray that when the time comes, that I will have the strength to make the choice to serve Jesus and not men. And he too was terrified that he would fail at that point. Over the next several months, and I'm talking about 6 months, the three men were kept in prison with no charge. And then one day, they were released. Of course, as protocol was, they went before a judge. And the judge looked and said, oh, there's no charge against them. There's no reason that they're here, so they have to be dismissed. And so Ahmed, Mustafa and Hassan were out of prison. Not that they ever were in prison for any reason other than the fact that the police arrested them. And Boutros came and he told them of all the things that had happened. You know, Brother Andrew had told people to write them letters. And Boutros had said to Brother Andrew, there's no point. There's no point writing these letters to them because, you know what, they're never going to get one of those letters. It's all censored. They're not going to get anything through the prison doors. And Brother Andrew said, ah, but the guards, or the people with the letters, censoring the letters, they will know that we haven't forgotten. And there were thousands of letters being sent to these three men. And when they came out, Brother Andrew actually came over to Libya and joined them to see the newly released prisoners. And you know, although they were thin and worn and bruised and battered, these three men were radiant. And Andrew brought out some of the letters. And Hassan picked up the letters and he started to read. And his eyes filled with tears as he said, people were praying for us that whole time? They didn't even know us? And Andrew put down article after article, people's response to the articles, more letters that had been sent to him to pass on. And these men were overwhelmed. The fact that people were praying for them. And Hassan said, you know, I remember there were several times when I was this close. After being tortured, I was this close to giving it all up and just forgetting all about it. But in that moment, I felt lifted. I felt refreshed, like there was a power behind me. And something just took away part of the suffering. And Brother Andrew said, yes, that's what the church is. If one member suffers, we are called to share in one another's sufferings. And Mustafa was so passionate after his time in prison. You know, he had seen true hopelessness. He had seen fellow prisoners who had committed serious crimes. And these prisoners, you know, they had judgment in this life and judgment in the next. That's what they believed. And he knew that these men had no hope, none at all. And they had no concept of forgiveness, of love, or anything like that. And Mustafa said, you know, our Muslim brothers and sisters need more and more for us to bring the good news. They need to understand that there is hope, that there's only hope in Jesus Christ. And Mustafa said, you know, I have a dream that one day I will actually go on the Hajj, which is the annual Muslim pilgrimage. And Ahmed and Hassan looked at him. And he said, yes, I'll go on the Hajj and I will stand on that rock and I will tell them all that Jesus is the only way. And Ahmed and Hassan looked at him and said, You're too bold for us. Ahmed was also very impacted by his time in prison. And it had really made him realize that he needed somehow to reconnect with his family. His family had very much rejected him, and he had very little contact. But he'd started to have a tiny bit of contact with his sister, Farah. And his sister had started asking very discreet questions, which suggested to Ahmed that she was thinking, searching, and perhaps there was more going on than he realized. And he really felt a strong need to return. Now, if you remember, Ahmed's family, his father wanted to kill him. His brothers, his cousins, they all said, it would be our honor to kill you for what you have done to our family and the shame you've brought by converting to Christianity. And Ahmed had been so hurt by the fact that the family had cut the contact, and not just cut contact, but wanted to kill him if he ever set foot in the house again. So to return home was not only terrifying, but it was also very hurtful for him. But his sister Farah helped. She organized it, and she promised him, and she said to him, our father has changed a lot. He's really, really changed. And he promises that there won't be any violence. It'll just be you and him. And so late one evening, Ahmed did return back to his hometown, and he came to his home, and he saw that his father was there. His father had been a heavy smoker all his life, and so his father actually had some really serious health problems, and he didn't have long to live. Well, that's what Ahmed thought when he looked at him. And after the formal greetings, Ahmed sat there across the table, and he was very awkward and very nervous. He didn't know what his father would say or if he would say anything at all. And then his father said, the secret police came here, you know. And Ahmed stiffened slightly at this. He didn't know what was going to come. And then his father said, I told them that until they told me what your charge was, what the formal charge was, then I wouldn't help them. I wouldn't give them a bit of information. They're idiots. Ahmed was very surprised. He thought that his father would happily hand over every ounce of information. But his father continued and he said, they think they can come in here and intimidate me and get me to give them information about my own son. And then he paused and he said, Ahmed, did they hurt you? And Ahmed said, yes, yes, father. It was very, very cruel. And his father sat in silence. And Ahmed was awash with emotion. He was a man who had wanted him dead, who didn't even care if he was alive or not. But now he had changed. He had protected him. he hadn't given any information over. And suddenly Ahmed looked on this man with so much love. He needed to tell him of Jesus. He really wanted this man to come to know the Lord. And so he determined that he would pray for him constantly. Now, then they talked about his work, and Ahmed's father said, you know, what are you doing? Are you working? And, of course, Ahmed said that he was working. He was actually starting to now to work with Boutros, who had set up an organization, sort of a charity-type organization that really supported Christians. And that Ahmed would be working and actually teaching people, Christians mainly, to read, because so many of them were uneducated and had no opportunity for education. And his father nodded and then said, just don't embarrass me. And of course Ahmed said, no sir. And then he finished by saying, and you need to get married. Don't worry, I'll arrange someone for you. And Ahmed, although he didn't like the sound of it, he just said, yes sir. And he left. Now Boutros at this time had also been thinking about marriage for Ahmed. But you see, this was a complex issue. For a Muslim background believer, no Christian would want to marry them. There was just this rule. You know, the Christians just wouldn't do it. It was too dangerous. And also, the government wouldn't allow it. They looked at your identity cards. If you were a Muslim, you were not allowed to change your religion on your identity card. If you were born a Christian, you could easily change it to Islam. But a Muslim couldn't. And if you had your identity cards, then if one was a Christian, one was a Muslim, you weren't actually allowed to get married. So of course these Muslim background believers had Muslim written on their identity card and they couldn't marry a Christian. But then of course they wouldn't want to marry a Muslim, and no Muslim would want to marry off their daughter to someone who'd converted to Christianity. And so they were only stuck with one option, and that is to find someone else who had been through the same experience. Another Muslim background believer, somebody who had also converted from Islam to Christianity. Then they would both have Muslim on their identity cards, but they would both be Christians. That was the only option. And Boutros had been thinking about this, but not only Boutros, also Abuna Alexander had been thinking about this. Because of course, there was this young lady by the name of Salima. She had escaped her very wealthy family after she had come to know the Lord from watching satellite TV. And she had been living in hiding with Abuna Alexander. And so separately, both of them had thought, these two are suited for each other. And not only that, it seems the Lord's provision. Both of them are Muslim background believers, and both of them seem like their characters would work together. And so they arranged a meeting, as is the tradition, and they all came together, the Boutros and Abuna Alexander and Salima and Ahmed. And Salima had known of Ahmed, she'd actually heard his testimony before in meetings, and of course Ahmed sort of knew Salima, a little bit about him, her, but you know, they didn't really know each other. And as they were sat around, you know, Salima sat listening to it all, and she really trusted Abuna Alexander and his wife as well. This elderly couple really cared for her and helped her deal with a lot of the trauma she'd experienced. So she trusted them. But she couldn't help thinking about all her childhood dreams. You know, she had always dreamt of her wedding day. She had dreamt of being married, and in her culture, and particularly her very wealthy family, weddings were a huge event, not one day, more talking about a couple of weeks of celebration. Lavish feasts, parties, she dressed upon dress, jewellery, all of this had made up so much of her childhood. It had been her dream, all her extended family coming. Her father had often talked about how beautiful she would be on her very important wedding day. And all of those dreams came flooding back as they sat around this bare coffee table. And she knew that they were organizing a wedding where her family would never come. The wedding itself would be secretive. They would do a traditional Muslim wedding for the government, and that would be it. No lavish feast, no family whatsoever. Her family would not even, she didn't even know if they would even care to know about her wedding. And here she was marrying someone, and And they talked as well, Abuna Alexander and Boutros, about how hard that marriage would be as Muslim background believers. You know, something as simple as giving your child a Christian name when you've got Muslim on your identity card would cause questions. They would always be caught in limbo, them and later on their children too. At school, their children would be isolated and picked on because of this interesting background they had. Christian parents, but they converted. It was not tolerated in Libya. So hearing all this, it made her feel like this was a very, very high price to pay. But she knew Ahmed was a good man and he followed Jesus. And she held on to the fact that Jesus would be her rock. And so in tears, she accepted Ahmed's offer of marriage. And as the tradition was, Ahmed's father met with Ahmed and, well, Salima's father wouldn't even come. Sent an uncle. And the uncle made it very clear to Salima that on her wedding day, she was never, ever to contact any member of her family again. She would be dead to them. And so that was Salima's experience. And on her wedding day, it was a very bittersweet day because she knew that her family, well, she was dead to them. Now soon, Ahmed and Salima's little flat in Souk al-Khamis in Libya, this little town where Ahmed was from, became a bit of a meeting place, a bit of a hub for Muslim background believers. Because in fact, Ahmed's sister, Farah, and her husband had actually been secretly seeking and searching, and they had found that the Lord Jesus is the way. They had found that on their own. And they now wanted to know more. They needed teaching. They were new converts. And soon Ahmed started to realize that separately there were different members of his extended family, a cousin here, a relative over there, that were starting to seek. People had seen the huge change in Ahmed and seen the huge reaction of the family. But even though they might have been involved in that and threatened to kill him at the start, it had impacted them and they wanted to know more. There were other people too. There was a man by the name of Nadia. Nadia owned a local candy store and he was a neighbour. He was not a devout Muslim. In fact, he was often drunk, he was in fights, he was a very angry man, he could also be very lazy. And his wife really, really struggled with him. And she would often come to Ahmed and say, please help me, please talk to him, do something. And Ahmed would go and talk to Nadia and encourage him and also talk to him a little bit about the Lord Jesus. When Nadia wasn't fussed about all of this. Until his candy shop started to fail, his business started to go down. And the reason for it was simply because people used to come in and say, please, I need to buy this, oh, an event coming up. Look, I'll pay you next week. I promise I will pay you. And of course they never came. And if they did come, they would say, just I need one more thing and just add it onto the list. I'll come, definitely I'll pay. And soon his business was actually starting to fail because people owed him so much but never came back to pay. And he was starting to get angry and more resentful. But then there came in a Christian one day. And the Christian did exactly the same thing and said, I can't pay you today, but don't worry, I'll come back on the Wednesday and I'll pay you then, I promise you. And Nadia was angry again, but he said, fine, you can do that too. But the Christian did come back on that Wednesday. And not only that, but he paid him back and paid him interest and extra to thank him for what he had done in allowing him to pay a bit later. And this tiny little act had a huge impression on Nadia. And so when Ahmed came again to teach him and talk to him and mention the Lord Jesus, he decided that he would listen. And he did listen. And not only that, but a huge change came over this man. And suddenly the drunkenness stopped, the fighting stopped. And his wife became quite scared. Because she came home one day and he was sat on the floor with his children and he was teaching them Bible stories. And she was scared, like, what had happened to him in such a short space of time? This man had completely changed. And then she wanted to know more. She desperately wanted to know what it was that had completely revolutionized his life and also changed their family. And soon she too became a believer and joined that little band of people who were meeting in Ahmed and Salima's flat. It was dangerous, and Mustafa would have to stay downstairs in the little printing office they had, and he had a button that he could press if there were unexpected visitors. And when he pressed the button, then upstairs they would turn it all into what looked like a birthday party. And in that way, any unsuspecting visitors would walk in and think it was just an ordinary party of some sort. They did have to be careful. But Ahmed really felt that this was his calling. And Mustafa and Hassan too, they really loved this kind of ministry. But they also started to work amongst Christians in villages and towns and in the outskirts. Now Boutros continued this work, and his work expanded. So he had little offices where, of course, he printed literature and things that he could distribute to different people he knew, different leaders, churches and so on. But then he realized that Christians were so marginalized and uneducated that often they were the poorest people in society. And so he set up literacy centers. And Ahmed, of course, was working there, and Salima. Salima did a lot of work amongst the women. She taught them literacy, but also basic health and hygiene, and she was based in those centers. And Mustafa and Hassan, they traveled to villages, so did Ahmed. They met with people, they gave them resources, and also on the side, they secretly were meeting with these Muslim background believers in different settings to really teach and disciple them. There had been threatening calls, but that was kind of normal. And it was certainly nothing that suggested to Boutros he needed to stop this work in any way. Essentially, it was meant to be just work amongst the Christians. Well, that's what it looked like on the outside, and that was still legal. But the threatening calls became more frequent. At the end of one team meeting, Salima was packing up the lunch, and Nadir and Mustafa were folding up the printing, and they were packing it into the back of Hassan's car. They also had a delivery of New Testaments from Bible Forum, and they were going, and Ahmed said goodbye to both of them, and he was going to drive 2 hours to another village to have another meeting with some Christians and give them some material. Hassan jumped in the car with Mustafa, and they were going to head back to the town. And it was a bit of a trek along some dirt roads, and they needed to make that delivery back to the main town. As they were driving down a dirt road, suddenly, out of the embankment, two cars cut them off. Hassan slammed on the brakes and swerved the car to avoid hitting them. But then when he looked again, in that instant, he realized he needed to get out. He slammed on the reverse and tried to reverse back. But because of the road and because it was dirt and mud, his tire got stuck and the car spun. Suddenly, his driver door was ripped open and Hassan was dragged out onto the dirt road. Mustafa, in that moment, he knew he had to run, and he took off across the field, but there were gunshots, and he fell down to the floor, and two men came and grabbed him. Hassan had already been stuffed into one car and it had taken off. Mustafa was put in another, and it took off as well. Meanwhile, Ahmed had driven that 2 hours and had arrived at his location. When he arrived, his phone started buzzing and he picked it up. It was Salima. She screamed down the phone. She said, "You have to get out. Get out. You have to get out. They've got Mustafa. They've got Hassan." And Ahmed said, "Slow down. What? Who? Who's got?" And she said, "I don't know. But they've said, they just rang me. They said, your husband is next. They need money. They want money." And she named the sum. It was far too much. How are we going to get that money? And then he said to Salima, "You've got to go. Don't go back to the flat. Go to Farah's house. Stay with Farah." And Ahmed thought, what to do now? Immediately he rang Boutros and told him the situation. Boutros said, "Leave it to me. I'll work out the money. But you need to get out. This is serious. Those threats, they weren't just threats. You don't return back." So Ahmed, well, he was just waiting. He didn't know what was frozen. Meanwhile, Mustafa and Hassan had been taken to a remote location, some abandoned barn at the back of a village nearby. They were badly beaten. There were possibly 6, maybe 8 people. They had also gone through Hassan's car. They'd found all the literature. They'd found the New Testaments. But unfortunately, they'd also found Mustafa's laptop. And once they'd gotten into that laptop, they were systematically going through all the files, and they were getting all the information, all of the centres, every name of every person who had been to those centres was there. And when they were downloading all of this information, Mustafa and Hassan were being held at two separate corners of the barn. And they couldn't talk to each other, they couldn't do anything. And then one of the men said, "Well, we've got it all now. What do we do with them?" And then he pointed to Hassan, "What do we do with him?" And one of the men said, "What do you think we do with infidels?" He pulled out a gun, shot him in the head. Hassan dropped to the ground. And Mustafa didn't even have time to react. One of the men came, and it was a man that Mustafa knew from his former days in the Muslim Brotherhood. And this man came to Mustafa and said, "Allah will reward us for wiping your memory off the face of this earth." And Mustafa was stabbed in the stomach, not once, but in a crazy, frenzied attack. And when his lifeless body fell to the floor, they bundled up both bodies and threw them in the boot of a car. The next morning, Salima came back to her flat. She came to get a few things. She was with Farah, and when she came to the door of her flat, she knew something was wrong. The door was slightly ajar, and it was clear that someone had forced the lock. She, very scared and very with lots of trembling, she pushed open that door and flicked on the light, and then she screamed. Because in the middle of the living room of her flat was the body of Hassan in a bloodied and dirty blanket. Abuna Alexander walked up the steps of St. Mark's Church, and at the top step he saw a figure, and he drew breath. Because there, on the top of the step of St. Mark's Church, thrown on a brown and bloodied blanket, was the brutalized body of Mustafa, with a note pinned to him, which explained everything, and said, "We have all the names. We want Ahmed next, and Boutros, or we will destroy every center and every person connected to this work." Abuna Alexander immediately contacted Boutros, and they already knew that they needed to get Ahmed into a safe place. Boutros found a safe place for Ahmed to be, but then he himself was taken in for questioning. And at first he thought, you know, the police, maybe they need to find Ahmed in order to protect him, because obviously he's named as the next victim. We've had two murders already and he's the third. But Boutros was wary. He didn't trust the police. And so when they were starting to question him and so on, he was very reluctant to give any information. In fact, he made sure that no one knew where Ahmed was except him. Even Salima didn't know where he was, because he didn't want anyone else to be questioned. And so when the police started to question him, suddenly one of the police chiefs said, "You know, we need to find Ahmed." And Boutros said, "Why?" And the police chief said, "Because of course he is our chief suspect in this crime." And Boutros said, "What? You're saying that he's the one that murdered Mustafa and Hassan?" And the man said, "Yes, of course. You see, he was the last person to see them, and now he's on the run. Guilty conscience." And Boutros said, "Are you kidding? Did you not see all those tie marks? There were two sets of tie marks. Clearly you could see how many footprints there were. It was mud. It's there for you. You can see it for yourselves. And they took them. They took them. We even think we know where they took them." And the police said, "Who took them? Can you give me names?" And of course, Boutros said, "Well, we don't know, but it's clear the Muslim Brotherhood must be behind this. Did you not see the note pinned to Mustafa's body? It even said that Ahmed was going to be next." why do you think Ahmed has done this? And they said, until you can give us names, Ahmed remains our chief suspect. We need to arrest him. And Boutros was so angry because he knew that they were just targeting Ahmed. They wanted in some way to pin this murder on him. And he knew that he needed to get Ahmed out of the country. It wasn't good enough to have him hide. They needed to get out there quick. The Muslim Brotherhood was not to be messed with. And you never knew where people who were sympathetic with them would be. So Boutros knew, he was starting to get more and more threatening calls himself. And they were telling him that he would be next. They knew his wife, they knew he had children. They even knew how old the children were, they knew everything. And they made it clear. And so Boutros said to Nadira, you've got to get out of here. Take the children, I want you to go and stay with your family. They lived in quite another city, and quite far away. And so Nadira took the children there, and Boutros himself, he decided that he needed to get out as well. And so he got a plane ticket, and the next day he flew out to Cyprus, and there he contacted Brother Andrew. And Boutros was terrified. Not only was he terrified, he was beside himself. He felt like he had failed. All his work had just kind of exploded in front of him. Two people were now dead, and they were hunting for Ahmed and him, and perhaps they had all the information, enough to destroy everything and anybody connected. He'd also heard Nadia had been arrested as well. And so Boutros didn't know what to do. And Brother Andrew told him, just stay right where you are. I'm going to fly out to meet you. Meanwhile, Karim had heard about all of this. For some reason, he knew what was going on. He also knew that the local police, the place that Ahmed and Mustafa and Hassan were, they were sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood. And so he knew that whatever happened, they would ignore all evidence and somehow just pin the murder on Ahmed, because they wanted Ahmed dead too. He also knew it was a very dangerous situation. Ahmed didn't have any papers to get out of Libya, didn't have a passport, etc. So Karim managed very quickly to arrange it all. He got all the paperwork done. He managed to get everything to Ahmed through Boutros. They worked it out some way. And all the paperwork, including a plane ticket to Cyprus, came into Ahmed's hands. And Ahmed flew out of Libya with all the necessary paperwork. And he joined Brother Andrew and Boutros in Cyprus. Now, in the meantime, Boutros knew that he had to work quickly. You see, if they pinned that crime on Ahmed somehow, and they could do it very easily, they didn't even need evidence. If they did it, then Ahmed would never be able to leave. You see, you can't get refugee status if you're a murderer. And so they needed to work quickly before anything else happened. And so they found that there was a brother Andrew knew, a brother in Canada, a businessman, and he was willing to sponsor Ahmed. And Ahmed and Salima could go and live in Canada. And they were telling Ahmed all of this, and they were saying, you know, there's safety. We can get you to Canada. Canada is a good place. You know, in fact, you know, you could go to theological college. You could become a pastor. You could learn. And you know, English is not too hard. Salima is so clever. She can learn. She'll be able to find new friends. You'll be able to start again, have a young family in a safe place. And Ahmed was listening to all of this, and then he stopped and he said, no. He became very upset and said, I'm an Arab. I speak Arabic. I was a Muslim and I converted to Christianity. I need to be with my people. And I need to tell Muslims about the Lord Jesus. I don't want to go to Canada. I want to go back. I want to tell people, my people, about the Lord Jesus. And they said, you know you can't go back. It is not safe. The minute you set foot in there, anything could happen. They'll charge you. You've been in prison your whole life. But Ahmed turned to Brother Andrew and said, I remember you saying this once. You said, God has told us to go, but he never promised that we would come back. And Boutros and Andrew were so challenged by Ahmed's faith and his determination to live and die for the gospel. Meanwhile, at St. Mark's Church, the congregation was really being targeted. Muslim Brotherhood had, again, incited a lot of hatred, and a very horrible situation had happened. A young girl had been abducted, kidnapped by a Muslim man in broad daylight. In fact, when she was walking home with her friends, she had been dragged into a car, and they knew what was going to happen. She was going to be forced to marry this man. But because she was a Christian and her family had been Christians for generations, she wasn't just going to be forced to be married. She was going to probably be a slave. That's what happened. So this girl, part of Abuna Alexander's congregation, had been kidnapped in this horrible way. Of course they went to the police, the family did, and the police said, oh, we interviewed the man, and the man said that she came so willingly and she's so grateful to put behind her her Christianity and embrace the one true religion, Islam. And the family, of course, knew that all this was just lies. But they couldn't do anything about it. The police dropped the case. They said it was good for her anyway. The congregation was angry, and they called a meeting with their priest. And when they came, they were seething with rage. And they said to this priest, they said, we need to fight. This place has been vandalized. People have had their homes burst into flames. Cars have been wrecked. Businesses have been completely ruined. And one of our daughters has been abducted. And we stand by and watch. We need to fight. We need to stand up for ourselves and stop this intimidation and injustice. The police aren't going to help us. We need to help ourselves. And Abuna Alexander, he wasn't a man of great courage. But at this point, he knew what he had to say. And he stopped them and said, no, this is not the way. We must be different. We must show them the love of Christ. That can be our only answer. And so he wanted to do something very different. And he felt the Lord was in this. He said, you know what we're going to do? With all this that has happened, we are going to have a public meeting in the marketplace. And I will speak. And the congregation just looked at him. How is this an answer? But he said, we must trust God in this. And I feel he is in it. And so a meeting was held, a public meeting in the centre of the town, and the congregation did come. And Abuna Alexander stood up there and he spoke. And he spoke about the love of the Lord Jesus. He spoke about forgiveness, and he made no mention of all that that community had suffered. There was no anger, no bitterness. And he spoke only of how much the Lord loved them. At the end of that meeting, a lot of people had gathered around, and when they packed it up, a sheikh from the local mosque came and he stood next to Abuna Alexander, and he said, not all of us approve of what's been happening to your community. And then he lowered his voice. And he said, I have never heard anyone speak of forgiveness and love. Please, can you give me some more information about this prophet Jesus? And one of Alexander's congregation was standing nearby and overheard. And he looked at the priest, and he realized then that Jesus is the only answer. And that this was the way. Now, after many, many months, when everything had died down a little bit, Boutros was able to return. And everything had been shut up and closed in that time. And all the centres had been abandoned. And when Boutros came back to reopen everything, he realised that next to his main centre, when he opened it all up, next to it had been built a huge mosque, and the speakers were facing down at their little centre. But the Christians took it with a lot of grace and humour. And five times a day it was a little bit loud as the call to prayer blasted at them. But there were so many more converts. And, you know, Boutros at that point needed more and more leaders. And more people were coming to know the Lord, Muslim background people. And it was actually Nadia who stood up and said, I want to step up to this because sheep need a shepherd. And I want to continue the work that my brothers Hassan and Mustafa started. And Ahmed and Salima, well, it wasn't safe for them. They were moved to another location, and I don't even know anything about it. The book where all of this is written, it makes no mention of any city, no clues are given. And so they were moved to another Middle Eastern city, is all we know. And Ahmed was able to find work with the Bible Forum. They had to keep a low profile. They were part of a church, but it was so hard for Salima. She had lost her family completely. But she had managed, and she'd started again, and she'd worked amongst the women, and she had made such a good connections and friendships with people in her town. And now again, all that had been taken away from her. And here she was starting again in the space of only a few years. It was so hard, because even though she was part of a church, people couldn't know about their background. And it was very, very hard for her to even make connections and friends with people because she was scared. But she remembered that Jesus is her rock. So the work of our brothers and sisters continues today. And of course, this story is unfinished because it's ongoing. And for all I know, Boutros and Salima and Ahmed are out there continuing this work. But I just want to finish with something that Ahmed wrote to Zaki right at the end here when he had just moved to this other Middle Eastern country and had started work with the Bible Forum. He contacted Zaki again. Zaki was his friend that had first mentioned to him that he should read the New Testament and find out about this man called Jesus. Ahmed wrote to him and said, "There is no escape from the real God. There is no escape from Jesus Christ. There is no God like him. He created us, loves us with a passion, and longs for the same from us in return. Zaki, thank you for introducing me to the God from whom I cannot escape and from whom I would never want to escape." And that's where our story ends today.